My name is Angie Michael. I'm the general manager of Hotel Sorrento, and we are sitting in the fireside room here at the hotel.
Do you remember the first time you heard about the Sorrento being haunted?
I did. It was when I was considering coming to work here. And it actually was one of the reasons that I became even more interested in the property and learning the history.
Tell me about one experience you had with this ghost.
Well, Hotel Sorrento is in the midst of a refresh or a renovation. And as I was talking about changes and what should we do next, my computer screens began to flicker. And being in an old building, I thought, okay, well, it must be an issue with my monitors. As I continued to talk about this change, someone made a joke about the ghosts. Maybe they're not so happy. And I said, well, you know, ultimately, we need to make an effect change. And at that point, all the lights went off in my office. And then one by one, each office went out. Now, that would have been fine, but there were no other power outages in the building. And when I immediately proclaimed, okay, no more changes, I promise. All of our lights came back on, my computer screens worked fine, and everybody looked at me and said, it is definitely about you.
Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU, and for Halloween, we're talking a little bit about some of our local spooky tales, including this one here at the Sorrento. And Angie Michael, why don't we reveal the identity of the ghost who haunts the halls of the Hotel Sorrento?
Well, that would be the infamous Alice B. Toklas.
Remind me who she is.
Alice Toklas was the life partner of Gertrude Stein. Alice lived in Seattle in the very early 1900s with her family here on First Hill, and eventually lived the rest of her life in Paris with Gertrude.
So where does she like to hang out here at the hotel?
Well, ironically enough, she didn't hang out at Hotel Sorrento. The lore is that the childhood home that Alice B. Toklas lived in was on the grounds that Hotel Sorrento was eventually built on. So as a child, she had very fond memories of this place. And as from what I know of Alice B. Toklas, as she grew older, she wrote about the happiest times of her life, which really happened to be on First Hill here in Seattle.
No kidding. So where in the hotel has her ghost found to be the most comfortable spot?
Well, up until I joined the Hotel Sorrento team, it's really been the fourth floor. Specifically, room 408 is where we have the most activity.
Room 408?
Mm-hmm. 408.
Do you know why that room?
Perhaps it could be where her home was, you know, that corner of where the hotel sits, because it is a corner. It is the corner that looks to Puget Sound. And if you read through some of her writings, she did talk about the beautiful views of the Puget Sound and the Olympics. So it very well could be that perhaps that is where the home sat.
Can we go check it out?
Are you nervous?
I feel like Alice B. Toklas and I would understand each other pretty well, so no, I feel okay.
Okay, great. Well, if you get scared, you can hold my hand.
Thank you.
So I recently took some additional guests up to 408. We have a lot of requests to see this space. And as I got into the elevator, when I hit the number 4 on our elevator panel, it would not light up. Yet when I got into the elevator to come downstairs, the light panel worked just fine. So let's try it again. We'll see.
Tricky.
It does work for a lot of people. Nope, it still won't work for me. But watch. And the elevator works.
Fascinating. All right. I'm just going to keep an open mind here.
Mm-hmm. I would keep an open mind and keep a keen eye.
What should I be watching for?
You know, people have seen apparitions of a woman wearing all black. There's been sightings of a woman wearing all white. There's been odd movement, noise. People have reported hearing screams coming from rooms that are vacant. Lights that turn on, doors that close on their own. Just unexplained phenomena.
Have you ever seen that apparition?
I haven't. I talk to Alice a lot when I come into the building. It's going to be a good day, Alice. That's what I tell her when I walk in the door every morning.
Do you believe in Alice and her ghost?
Absolutely. I believe in all of the ghosts in this building. Maybe I'm a little crazy, but I have to believe that at the end of this, we all get to go where we ultimately were the happiest or where we felt the best in our life. And I feel honored that she chooses to come back here.
Well, we're going to have more legends, spooky tales, and ghost stories here on Sound Effect for our special Halloween edition today. I want to thank you, Angie Michael, for showing me around the haunted Hotel Sorrento.
It's my pleasure.
And the rest of you guys, stick around. Lots more coming up. Don't go away. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Here on this Halloween, we are going to revisit some of our favorite tales of the otherworldly. And we'll start with this one that aired in our Origin Stories show. We begin with the outgoing voicemail message from a guy named Bill Puckett.
Please leave your name, your phone number, and the best time to call if you're reporting a UFO sighting. Leave name, phone number, the date of your sighting, the time of your sighting, the city, state, and country of your sighting, and a brief description, and your call will be returned.
Puckett is providing a public service of sorts. What he'll do is record your account of your UFO sighting and investigate it. He's a longtime Washington resident, and now he lives in Helena, Montana, and that's where he runs this group called UFOs Northwest. Thinking about how Bill's interest in UFOs began, he says he remembers hearing about flying saucers during one of those early waves of sightings.
You know, they were scary. I mean, it created a national panic. I mean, it was in the national press, and it scared me. Of course, later on, I kind of piqued my curiosity, but in the 1950s, it was a pretty scary phenomenon.
So like a lot of things in childhood, first it scared you, and then it sort of intrigued you?
Right, absolutely.
And part of what captivated Bill Puckett was hearing about this one specific incident that took place in Washington over the Cascade Mountains, an episode that formed the origin story for the entire modern UFO phenomenon.
Oh, I knew about the Kenneth Arnold incident when I grew up back here in Montana in the 1950s. I mean, UFO sightings were in the national news in those days, and it was well known that that's when it started, and it was June 24th, 1947.
Would you sort of walk me through the Kenneth Arnold incident?
Well, on June 24th, 1947, Kenneth Arnold got in a light aircraft in Chehalis, Washington, and he was going to fly to Yakima. And he was a search and rescue pilot. And there was a lost plane over Mount Rainier. He thought he would divert a little bit, check out if he could see if he could find this plane. And while he was doing that, these nine silvery objects, sort of shaped kind of like boomerangs, not quite complete disc-shaped objects, he saw flying out ahead of him. He clocked them between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams, and I believe that he estimated their speed at upwards of 1,800 miles an hour. Of course, at that time, we had jet aircraft, a few, but none of them would fly that fast. That's when the UFO, modern wave of ufology got started, because the press got note of it, and the actual term flying saucer was coined by one of the press officers.
Can you spell out how the term flying saucer came about?
I think Kenneth Arnold, you know, used the analogy, they look like saucers skipping on water.
So that term flying saucer has really taken hold in the popular imagination. And now when we think about a UFO or an alien craft, it's almost always saucer shaped, or often anyway. But what Arnold described wasn't saucer shaped, right?
Not exactly. They were more boomerang shaped. However, subsequent to that, you know, there's been a lot of flying saucer sightings.
How would you describe the reaction and the kind of publicity that followed Arnold's story?
Well, it generated a lot of publicity, and, you know, there was a newscast.
We are honored indeed to have here in our studio this man, Kenneth Arnold, who we believe may be able to give us a first-hand account and give you the same on what happened.
They looked something like a pie plate that was cut in half with a sort of a convex triangle in the rear. Now, I thought, well, that maybe their jet planes with just the tails painted green or brown or something, and didn't think too much of it, but kept on watching them.
It generated a lot of newspaper articles, and then it also seemed to get the military's attention, because it wasn't too long after that they started Project Sign, and of course, the famous Roswell incident happened only a couple weeks after the Kenneth Arnold sighting. I think something really happened, because there were just hundreds and hundreds of sightings that summer of 1947. They started in June. They peaked in around the 7th of July, around the time the Roswell crash. And then they tapered down to real low numbers later in August. It wasn't just all press bias.
For people who are into ufology and studying this stuff, what is the significance of the Kenneth Arnold story?
Well, I would call it perhaps a Rosetta Stone of UFO sightings. Some people would say that'd be Roswell, but I would say that. The flying discs are still seen. I mean, I've had reports here just this past week. I'm trying to acquire photos from this woman that saw a flying disc in eastern, or I should say western Kansas, and saw a being inside of it. The disc was quite close to her. The significance of that is that they were unexplained in 1947. They're still unexplained in 2015.
Do you think that Kenneth Arnold, was he a believer?
Yeah, he wrote a book. I'm looking at it right now, The Coming of the Saucers. So yeah, certainly he was a believer. However, later in his life, he wished he had never even got into it because it just involved a lot of harassment. And I don't know whether it affected his run for lieutenant governor of Idaho or not, but he kind of regretted later in life of being involved with it.
Is that a feeling that you understand? That feeling of, gosh, I wish I had just kept my mouth shut?
Absolutely. I mean, even myself as a UFO investigator, I've been targeted by neighbors and stuff as kind of a crackpot. You know, what's this guy doing investigating UFOs? If you're not amiable to public criticism, it's best to be more discreet about your beliefs. However, skeptics do have some ammunition. I mean, there is a lot of deception in the UFO field, this chemtrail nonsense and Planet X in 2012, even though that's not totally UFO, it's UFO related. And, you know, you start talking that kind of junk around scientists and they're going to say, you know, what planet do you reside? I mean, it's, you know, it's not reliable information. And I try to stick with forensics and photos and videos and radar data, but I still can't prove scientifically that UFOs are non-terrestrial or higher dimensional or, you know, due to other paranormal phenomena. I believe it, but I can't prove it.
Is it ever lonely to believe something that mainstream science and culture dismiss?
Somewhat. You know, it would be nice to have the support of the scientific community, politicians. It's a bit frustrating, but, you know, it's just, it goes with the territory.
Well, William Puckett helps to run UFOs Northwest, and we'll link to his site on our webpage, kplusoundeffect.org. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you very much for inviting me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and for Halloween, we're bringing back some stories of the strange, the eerie, the fantastical. And next, we revisit a classic urban legend. So it's one that I, for one, have definitely encountered in a bunch of places I've lived. The legend goes that there is a secret network of tunnels beneath the city, and that allows all kinds of mysterious people and activities to remain unseen. Well, I don't know why, but one of the most persistent versions of this legend happens to be set in Tacoma. And that's interesting because there's almost no actual evidence of these tunnels, no remnants of tunnels, no real reliable accounts. And so for our Northwest Myths and Legends show that aired back in January, Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad set out to get to the bottom of this legend, to figure out if it's true, and more importantly, what it means. He joined me to explain what he found.
Well, like in a lot of cities, there's lots of stories and lots of speculation. There's stories of brothels and taverns having these trap doors with tunnels that would lead to secret basements, and the owners of these establishments would get clientele good and intoxicated to the point of passing out, drop them down through these secret doors, through these secret tunnels, into secret basements, and basically sell these poor souls off to trading ships in Commencement Bay before they came to and would end up being put to work on these boats. And that's actually a very common urban legend for a lot of West Coast port cities. Other legends suggest a tunnel where businessmen could park their wagons on one side of the street, walk into a legitimate business, then crawl into a tunnel in that legitimate business, which led under the street to brothels or opium dens or perhaps even bars during Prohibition in another location.
Okay, this is starting to sound familiar. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've heard versions of this before where it's a den of vice or an iniquity and the tunnels are conveyances to and from in secret. So is that mostly what you've heard about these Tacoma tunnels?
Actually, the most common stories seem to revolve around Chinese immigrants living in Tacoma, but the accounts seem to vary. So I went to Tacoma, where I found Phyllis Harrison. She's done extensive research on the subject of these so-called Chinese tunnels. And we started our conversation by talking about the stories she heard growing up.
The stories that I heard were, for the most part, that there was a network of tunnels under North and West Tacoma that had been built by the railroads, and they were used to smuggle coolie laborers, which was the term that we used at that time, into Tacoma to work on the railroads. My father had heard the same story. He told us about being in a tunnel out by Fircrest, an area that is now called China Lake, that he'd been in an entrance to such a tunnel. And he described it as a cave. It had fallen in, it was blocked off, whatever, you couldn't go very far. And he said there were actually bunks in there and that they had found some Chinese coins.
So Gabe, those were the stories that Phyllis knew as a child.
Okay, so childhood stories are one thing. But what did she discover once she started to get into her actual academic research?
Well, once she started working on her doctoral degree in folklore, she found out the story that she knew as a child was not at all the story that was told in the latter third of the 1800s.
Chinese immigrants played a large part in settling Tacoma in the early days, as they did up and down the West Coast, partly because they were willing to do the work that other people were not necessarily willing to do, and they didn't have the opportunities that other people had. And in the 1860s, as things began to go a little bit sideways, for whatever reason, whether it was because people wanted jobs or needed a scapegoat or whatever, anti-Chinese sentiment grew pretty rapidly on the West Coast. And in Tacoma, it boiled over to the point that the Chinese community, which was largely in the area, I believe, around Stadium High School and what's now Schuster Parkway, were rounded up and driven out of town. It's an ugly piece in our history. So the earliest stories, accounts that I saw, say, from the late 1800s in Tacoma newspapers, talked about opium dens, Shanghai sailors. They were not so much connected with the railroad as they were connected with very, very negative images of Chinese people and somehow images of danger and that sort of thing, danger to the Tacoma population. So it was a very negative stereotype.
So, Gabe, basically what you had in the beginning, in the origin of this story, is people in Tacoma needed an excuse, a justifiable excuse to drive Chinese immigrants out of Tacoma. So they painted this awful picture of things that they were allegedly doing, and that's the origin of the Tacoma Tunnel story.
I see, yeah. And so it's kind of like it's propaganda in a way, but that has made its way into the realm of folklore. And in that sense, even if it's not true with a capital T, it still expresses a truth about the place that it comes from, about the attitudes and the culture that it sprung from.
Right, and as the attitudes evolved, so did the story.
Over time, those stereotypes changed as the dominant culture perception of Chinese people changed, so that the story I grew up with was a little bit more sympathetic, suggesting somewhat the exploitation of Chinese immigrants to work on the railroads.
So that's some really interesting background on the evolution of this Tacoma Tunnel legend, but did you ever find any evidence that the tunnels even existed? Do you believe that these tunnels ever existed?
There was an abandoned railroad tunnel, and I believe that that is documented. And my interest as a folklorist, Kevin, I was interested in the stories people told. So I'm always hard-pressed when people say, you know, do you, well, I mean, when I was a kid, I believed implicitly there was this network of tunnels that opened into people's basements and on and on and on. When I was doing that research, it truly didn't matter that much to me whether or not there were tunnels. I was more concerned about what people said about them. To my knowledge, there's never been any tunnel documented that wasn't something like a steam tunnel under Stadium High School that didn't have some other explanation. And as I understand, I hope this won't be disappointing lots and lots of people, but as I understand it, the geography of Tacoma is such that it would be highly unlikely that anybody could dig a vast system of tunnels.
Now, wait a second. I have to say, I do feel a little disappointed. I hate to admit it, but I kind of wanted there to be tunnels under Tacoma. I want there to be this secret world that you can't see, this hidden world. I don't know. Did you feel that way?
You're disappointed. I'm disappointed. I went looking for these things. I took this dark walk down the stairway in the basement of an old bar that used to be a brothel 100 years ago to the sealed off door, hoping that I would find something that no one in Tacoma had found before. But there's really no evidence to it. And as Phyllis says, it's not about the evidence. It's not about being able to find these tunnels. It's about the stories.
I think that we are a community that's very connected with the past. Our dramatic and unfortunate history with Chinese immigrants certainly has got to have something to do with how those stories have developed.
That is Phyllis Harrison. She has a doctorate in folklore, and she has spent years researching the alleged underground tunnels in Tacoma, and she talked about it with KPLU's Kevin Kniestad. Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Gabe.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to a very spooky edition of Sound Effect from KPLU. And right now I'm joining you from the auditorium in the Northwest Film Forum here in Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle, and I'm with artistic director Courtney Sheehan, and we're going to talk about some scary movies that originate here in the Pacific Northwest. Courtney, do you like scary movies? What scares you in a horror movie?
You know, it's funny. I'm not personally a huge horror fan, although I do very much appreciate the genre. And I think that the first scary movie that really got me was The Sixth Sense.
So we're going to talk a little bit about some scary movies that have emerged from the Northwest film scene and from our region here, starting with this interesting project called 13 Chambers. What is it exactly?
Yeah, so this is a brand new thing that I just found out about. This local firm called Smart House Creative is doing it, and they're doing it in partnership with a kind of art and technology nonprofit called Actions Art. And basically, there's this old schoolhouse that is down near the Amazon campus, right off of Denny on Westlake, that is about to be torn down. But right now, it's just this vacant, kind of creepy school building, and what they're doing is having 13 young women filmmakers, actually I think they're filmmakers of all ages, but they're all women, make a bunch of horror movies in the building before it gets torn down.
So it's like a haunted house kind of, and they're shooting short creepy movies in there?
Yeah, the idea is to make an anthology film out of all of these shorts that they'll be directing over maybe just the course of a week or a weekend. It's like really quick turnaround because this building's going to be demolished at the end of this month.
What's interesting, taking this space that's in transition that's going to soon enough be a big apartment complex or condos or something in this gentrifying and very rapidly changing neighborhood and kind of grabbing it and freezing it in this filmic amber a little bit.
Totally. It's very kind of resonant with what's happening in Seattle right now, and it seems an entirely appropriate capturing of this moment in this time and place not far from the Amazon campus.
And do you know why female directors specifically?
I think the company, Smart House Creative, along with their partner, Julia from Actions Art, is just really huge advocates of addressing the kind of appalling gender gap in the film industry, and this is a great way to do it. And the horror genre, of course, is something that we don't typically see a lot of female directors working in.
No, we do not. However, there is a feature film that you guys showed pretty recently that is a feature-length horror film shot here in Washington State by a local Seattle director. That film is called Dead Body. Can you kind of lay it out for us?
Yeah, so Dead Body is directed by Bobbin Ramsey, just played during the Local Sightings Film Festival here and is about to play again in the New York City Horror Fest in November. And it's just one of those kind of classic tales of a group of high school friends going to a cabin in the woods for a camping trip, and then all of a sudden they start dying one by one, and the group has to figure out which one of them is the killer.
The window is closed and locked. There's no way the killer could have gotten out that way.
Dude, seriously, who the f*** cares?
But that means...
No, wait!
The killer could still be in the house.
So it's a horror movie, a mystery, a kind of classic ghost story. It was filmed around here somewhere?
Yeah, it was shot in Shelton and Carnation over the course of 11 days.
I have to say, the misty, rainy, woodsy landscape of our Pacific Northwest region seems to match up really nicely with that particular genre. This movie is a little unusual, like, in its tone. How would you describe the mood of the movie?
Just looking at the title, Dead Body, kind of hints at this. It's almost a exploration of the category or the genre of film itself. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know? It's combining elements of... As Brian Miller, the Seattle Weekly critic, wrote, home country comedy with the kind of gory horror that you see in these slasher flicks. And it's got a bit of a reflexive sense of humor about itself, too. Like, let's say that there's some tension in the film revolves around which colleges the friends in the group got into.
And it doesn't seem like it's as self-conscious as, like, the Scream movies or something, where it's really outright about horror movies. And yet you get these moments where they like break out this whole laundry list of like weapons. So it definitely knows what it's doing.
All right, move. I got Eli's shovel. Okay, I got a hacksaw, a knife. I got two flashlights. I got a hammer, a hook, and a nail gun. Grab a weapon, we're under attack.
Yeah, it's almost more like Joss Whedon and reminded me a little bit of his Cabin in the Woods movie, which is literally called Cabin in the Woods, where it's acknowledging in a way the conventions of the genre and playing with them, but not completely dismantling them. And that's how it's still effective and it still ends up being scary, because you're convinced that this world is real.
So as somebody who's not a natural horror movie genre freak like yourself, did it move you or interest you? Or what, was there anything in it that stuck with you since you saw it the first time?
Totally. I was just really impressed that this is, you know, an early career woman director taking on a pretty ambitious first feature project. And also, I think the performances from the actors is interesting, because the way that the film was cast, all of the characters who knew each other in real life had also known each other in the film, and these were people that had acted together through college, and here they were playing friends who had just finished high school. And then the characters in the film who were strangers were also strangers in real life and hadn't worked with anyone on the project before, so that's kind of a distinctive element.
And there's gore, but it's not quite like really disgusting, I would say. And it's not like Tarantino-esque, right?
Sure, on a scale of 1 to 10, you might call it like a 6.5 or 7 on the gore level.
That's pretty good. So that falls within the comfort zone of more people, I'm guessing. That film is called Dead Body. It's directed by local director Bobbin Ramsey. We'll have the trailer up on our website, kplusoundeffect.org. And Courtney Sheehan, how are you doing Halloween here at the Film Forum? Anything special?
We're doing something called Spook House. We're turning the entire venue into a haunted house, along with the Satori Group, this really excellent experimental theater group in town. And they are going to contort all of the spaces, both of our theaters, the back hallways, into a really creepy, effective performance art haunted house that has a special theme around child stars.
Wait, why child stars?
Do you have to ask? I mean, they're so creepy.
All right, well, that special child star themed spooky movie house horror show type thing is happening here at the Northwest Film Forum. Thanks so much, Courtney Sheehan. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you too.
It's Sound Effect from KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here, and for our Halloween show today, we're going to take a look back at a favorite Northwest legend. This guy. That's the sound of what might be the most enduring myth in the Pacific Northwest. Bigfoot. Of course, what I really mean is that's allegedly the sound of something that the vast majority of people say doesn't exist. Most of what passes for evidence for Sasquatch is pretty sketchy, but there are actually a few people out there who've made it their mission to do a scientifically rigorous investigation of the Sasquatch phenomenon. And one of them is Dr. Jeff Meldrum. He's a professor of anatomy and anthropology in the Department of Biological Sciences at Idaho State University. And I'm giving his full title there so you can understand that whatever you think of his research, this guy is at least a credentialed scientist. And when we spoke to him earlier this year for our Northwest Myths and Legends show, he was preparing for one of the largest scientific hunts for Bigfoot to date. He says he got serious about Sasquatch when he encountered some evidence that he couldn't just write off.
I was traveling through Washington. The opportunity presented itself to visit someone who had a lot of evidence, the footprint casts, which I was very keenly interested in. He showed me a long line of tracks, 15-inch tracks. There were 35, 45 individual footprints. Very clear, unmistakable. I mean, these either had to be a very clever hoax or this was the real thing. And that's what kind of made the hair literally stand up on the back of my neck is as I, from my perspective of expertise, considered these remarkable footprints, it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. My gosh, a Sasquatch just walked by here last night. That really set the hook. I didn't see how I could walk away from this evidence.
So how would you kind of assess the state of Bigfoot research as it stands now? I mean, you said that these footprints were some of the most compelling evidence you had seen. How would you size up the field?
Well, I've been at this for nearly 20 years, and I have perceived that there is a shift in attitude. This really came, was driven home with the recent discovery of Homo floresiensis, the hobbit, as it's commonly known, this diminutive hominin in Southeast Asia that for which skeletal remains have now been found that are just a few tens of thousands of years old, which is a snap of the fingers in geologic time. The prospect that there could be branches of a very bushy family tree persisting alongside us, even into the present, isn't so far-fetched anymore.
So in pursuit of that question, you have a pretty elaborate research project in the works. Can you explain what it consists of?
Yes, I was approached by a gentleman who actually had an encounter, a close encounter with a Sasquatch in the northern Sierras a number of years ago, and he became just engrossed with the challenge of confirming that experience. And after consultation with many engineers and designers and pilots and so forth, he settled on an aerial survey approach and determined that the best way to do that would be a lighter-than-air ship, a helium-filled drone that could be flown at a considerable altitude and would have enough capacity for a long-duration flight with enough payload to accommodate very high-end thermal imaging equipment to try to make contact with a hot object that might fit the profile of a large bipedal primate. And then, of course, verify that on the ground with a ground insertion team. And they will spend at least a six-month period, 24/7, surveying on the ground a potential site for ultimate deployment of this airship, which is dubbed the Aurora.
And the Aurora is it's a drone? I mean, you're using a drone to hunt
Sasquatch.
That's right.
Now, it's different than what most people might envision when they hear the word drone. It's a 35-foot dual air cell catamaran-style airship, you know, like a miniature Hindenburg, only we'll hope that it doesn't have the same fate as the Hindenburg. And, you know, that's when the work really begins. You know, a creature like this, if indeed they exist, they're nocturnal, they're rare in the environment, they're very far-ranging, very, very generalized in their diet. That profile makes for a very difficult species to study in its natural setting.
You did say, you know, if Sasquatch exists, does that mean that you are agnostic at this point, or do you believe that it's out there? It's mm-hmm. You're open to the possibility that it's not. Where do you stand with that?
In the colloquial use of the term "believe," you know, do you believe in this? It usually connotes a position more akin to faith or the acceptance in the absence of evidence. Whereas, but for me, belief has no bearing on it. As a scientist, I am grappling with the evidence at hand, and on the basis of that evidence, you know, personally, I'm quite convinced.
What do you think the chances are of you finding Sasquatch?
Oh, I think they're pretty good. I mean, I have spent months and months at a time in the field, on the ground, surveying for trace and physical evidence, and have found on, you know, more than a half a dozen occasions, footprints that I can't attribute to any other form of wildlife or human, hair samples that defy attribution to any known wildlife species. You know, so given that, being able to coordinate a ground effort with that eye in the sky, I think will just broaden the prospects and increase the chances of us detecting something.
Let me ask you this, Professor Meldrum. I mean, if you don't find anything, at what point does it, I mean, is there a point at which it makes sense to stop looking?
Well, I think that point's quite far away. I can't see that happening in my lifetime, quite honestly, because of the things that have occurred, the things that, the conclusions that I have drawn through my personal research. Now, the onus is still upon me to disseminate those conclusions more effectively, perhaps, to my colleagues, and to see a shift in the attitudes generally.
What have you given up, or what challenges has this presented to you professionally and personally?
Well, I have a thick skin, and it takes a lot to get under it, but when it has come to periods of evaluation for advancement or for promotion and tenure, there have been some unfortunate behavior on the part of a number of my colleagues. It's often, you know, the reaction from even within my department, which is a bit of a microcosm of the broader scientific community, has, as you might expect, spanned the gambit. And so it was an eye-opening experience to jump into that deep end of the pool and realize that rather than throwing you a lifeline, there were people with poles to push you under the surface. So I'm certainly more more realistic in my attitudes towards the conduct of science and the politics, you know, to be blunt, the politics of science.
Jeff Meldrum is a professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. Our interns are Warren Langford and Casey Hicks. We get web help from David Nogueras, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. The following are places where you can find us and or interact with us. Facebook, Twitter, the World Wide Web, that's kplusoundeffect.org, iTunes, the place to subscribe to our podcast, as well as rate and review the show, and email soundeffect@kplu.org. See you next week when we'll be talking star power.
I'm driving home in the pouring rain in Houston, and
I was going to community college at the time. I was waiting tables at the Houston Country Club and thought, what would that be like? I mean, you know, what would that be like to be in the circus?
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.